Today's Taisho will be on case 14 in the Mumonkan, the Wu Men Kuan. Case 14 is entitled Nansen Cuts the Cat in Two. Nansen Osho, Nanchuan, saw monks of the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and said, "If you can give an answer, you will save the cat. If not, I will kill it." No one could answer, and Nansen cut the cat in two. That evening, Zhaozhou returned, and Nanchuan asked him of the incident. Zhaozhou took off his sandal, placed it on his head, and walked out. "If you had been there, you would have saved the cat," Nansen remarked. Mumon's comment. Tell me, what did Zhaozhou mean when he put the sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree was carried out with good reason, if not danger. Mumon's verse. Had Zhaozhou been there, he would have done the opposite. When the sword is snatched away, even Nansen begs for his life. So once again, I want to thank everybody for sitting so deeply this morning. This kind of long, long sustained sitting is indispensable. You know, it's definitely the case that if you practice rarely during the week, this kind of sitting is very difficult, if not impossible. It's like running a marathon and never having done any training beforehand. Many people practice sometimes quite faithfully, meditating for short periods. But this long, sustained sitting is absolutely priceless. It's really indispensable. It takes several days, in fact, really for the mind to begin to become clear. So I want to applaud everybody for doing this, for taking the time out, both in person and online, making the time for this really important, the most important thing, I would say. So this is a terrible story. Let me just say that I have a cat. His name is Henry. He's a wonderful cat. He is funny. He's really a genius among cats, you know. So I'm not an advocate of violence against animals of any kind. This is a story that I hope is not true. It might be true, and it might not. But it's making a very important point. The temple in question here, Nansen's temple, had two wings, an eastern wing and a western wing. And a cat somehow came onto the temple grounds, and the monks of the eastern wing, maybe they were a little lonely, and they fell in love with this cat. If you have a cat, you know how lovable they are. And they began to bring the cat rice and maybe pieces of tofu and things like that. And, you know, pretty soon the monks of the Western Wing saw their brothers in the Eastern Wing with this cat. You know, and they were maybe, you could imagine that they're envious, right? They see this little cat, all the monks of the Eastern Wing are showering it with affection. They don't have a cat. So, you know, maybe one day they go over and they take the cat over to the Western Wing. And they bring the cat some rice. And pretty soon the two wings of the temple are competing with each other for ownership of the cat, right? And this is becoming like an obsession. You can imagine that, you know, it's difficult to make sacrifices in life. You know, if you become a home leaver, that's a very rigorous and demanding life, very noble, you know, I would say. A very noble, lofty decision, and it's absolutely to be praised in every way. You know, you also make sacrifices, right? You know, my Dharma grandfather, Miauchi Kanko, had two robes, a winter and summer robe, and he had like zero personal property, right? He had a razor for shaving his head, a bowl for begging, right? And he slept on the tatami mat, on his futon, on a tatami mat. So, you know, that's a very demanding, noble life, right? And I can easily see that these monks might be, you know, a cat coming into their world would be so wonderful, right? Something they can shower their affection on. And you know, so it makes sense that these two groups of monks would argue over the possession of the cat. But, you know, Nanchuan's coming into the Chan Hall, the Zendo, and he notices that the monks are really not sitting very deeply. You know, they're all sitting on their cushion thinking about the cat, you know, which you know, it's understandable, human thing. But he's getting really alarmed because nobody is practicing the great way. Nobody is going to wake up this way, right? You know, maybe they're sitting on the cushion and they're thinking, well, you know, it's prohibited to bring meat into the temple, but maybe I can get somebody to bring some fish in and we'll give it to the cat or something like that. And they're not doing something so important, which is what we're doing here. And one day, Nansen tries to break the spell. You know, he says, well, maybe he says you can share the cat. You know, the West Wing gets it on Tuesdays and Fridays, and the, you know. But none of that works. And finally, he's so concerned, he comes into the Chan Hall, the Zen Hall, with a sword, which is, of course, a complete violation. It's a violation of the basic precept, right? Do not, because the Buddha did not kill, I will not kill, right? So he comes in and he says, if one person in this room can manifest awakened mind, I will spare the life of the cat. But if nobody can manifest enlightened mind, I will kill this cat. Now, this is a story, right? Don't do this at home. But he cuts the cat in two. Cuts the cat in two. It's a horrible, horrible thing. Okay. So that's the koan. And if you work with the koan, you can say cuts in two. That's the turning phrase. Cuts in two. Cuts in two. So, you know, what is this koan all about? You know, I work with people. I work in a university. I'm an English professor. And I work with people who are super bright. You know, like super bright. They went to the best college. Some of them went to like Oxford, right? They're very smart. And they know things. We have a wonderful saying in English, he's forgotten more than you know. Do you know that? In other words, a person knows so much that what he's forgotten is more than you know, right? These people have forgotten more than I know, right? So very smart. But you know, actually they're not enlightened. They're not enlightened. You know, I have a lot of friends who are like brilliant artists. I have friends who are artists, And some of them are painters and some of them are photographers. One time I missed a Friday sit because I had to go see a show by one of my friends. And when I look at their work, I just think, you know, I could not do something so brilliant no matter how hard I tried, you know, so, so brilliant, but not enlightened, not enlightened. See, you can be very successful in your life. You could be a CEO. You could invent a new computer program, you know, that kind of thing, but not enlightened. So you know, what does it mean to be enlightened anyway? You know, in English, when we talk about enlightened, we use the word all the time, but I don't think we really know what it means to be enlightened. I think when you read books on Buddhism too, they use the word enlightenment, but it's not always clear what enlightenment is, right? So when I was starting to practice Zen, I imagined that enlightenment was some kind of a very special experience. I didn't know what it was, but I was sure it would be something extraordinary. Maybe the Buddha would appear before me, you know. I remember when I was training with Genki Roshi, I was working on a koan and I could not answer the koan. I could not answer that koan. And I had a dream, and in my dream, I was staring at a wall, and all of a sudden the golden Buddha sort of came out of the wall. And I was so sure that this was the answer to my koan, I went in to see my teacher in Dokusan, and I said, "The golden Buddha." And Genki Roshi said, "No, that's not the answer." And then he rang the bell and I had to leave.
Okay.
So, you know, when we think of a friend of mine who's Japanese said that he was training in a temple in Japan. As you know, Japanese people have earthquakes, right? And he was in a sesshin in Japan, and he's a monk. And he said he was working on his koan, and all of a sudden he said he felt the ground move under him, shaking. It was like the walls were moving, and he thought, this is it, enlightenment. And then somebody grabbed him and said, "Quick, earthquake, you know, get out of the building." So what is enlightenment anyway? What is enlightenment? You know, in the Diamond Sutra, which we've been reading in our sutra study group, the Buddha says, "He who seeks me by sound, or he who seeks me in form, wrongly turned are his footsteps." See, what could that mean? What is the Buddha talking about? You know, you can read books on Buddhist philosophy, and you can look at beautiful Chinese paintings, you know, Japanese scrolls, looking for enlightenment, looking. And, you know, actually you'll never find it if you look for it in the wrong place or in the wrong way. That's really important. And the Diamond Sutra says, no matter where you look, you won't find it if you're looking in the world of form. That's what it actually says. See. So, you know, one way to think about, what every once in a while, people realize that the real world is not real. They realize that the real world is not real, you know? It's like every once in a while that happens to people. Sometimes it's a crisis, right? I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but where something happens that's so jolting, right? So jolting that you suddenly step back and you realize none of this is real. I don't know if you've had that experience. My brother, when I was 50 years, when I was about 53 years old, my brother got cancer and died of bone cancer. And everybody was kind of hoping that he would make it, right? And it often happens that people in treatment seem to get better and then they die. This happens fairly often, right? So my brother started to get better and we were all thinking, oh, he's going to get better, you know? And then he died. And I remember when that happened, you know, getting the phone call from my sister. And I went outside and it was like everything around me just for a moment, you know, when you have a blow like that, you suddenly realize, you know, this is all strangely unreal. This is strangely unreal. This can happen in other ways too. You may have had this experience where maybe something's happened to you that's humiliating or embarrassing, you know. And suddenly it's as though everything just sort of disappears for a moment and you're in a place you don't even know how to describe it, right? I don't know, right now I don't know where I am. I'm just not in the so-called real world. Those are actually, believe it or not, those are actually glimpses of enlightenment. Those are glimpses, moments of actual enlightenment. You know, from the Buddhist standpoint, this world is like a movie. It's like a movie. You know, if you are a character in the movie, you don't know you're a character in the movie. You think the movie is real, right? You know, so you're following the script, you're going through your life, you're doing what you're supposed to do, all the characters are saying the right thing to you, the movie seems totally real, right? From a Buddhist standpoint, that's actually what people call reality. It's a fabricated world. Right? And it's held together by our habits, by our energy habits, you know. And every once in a while, we realize it's not real. We just, maybe a crisis, as I said. Sometimes it's a moment of like deep joy or deep connection, you know. Suddenly you realize that all of this that I thought was real is really unimportant, right? Even when people come to Sesshin, this happens in a very subtle way. You know, when people decide to come to a meditation retreat, they have all of this stuff they have to do that seems so important. And they think, oh, I don't have time to come to a meditation retreat. I just don't have time. And then they get here, and the first day they think, oh my God, you know, I didn't finish that memo. When I get back on Monday, all that work is going to be waiting for me. You know, around day three, they realize, oh, who cares? It's like suddenly all of that seems so unimportant. And it's like you're in a totally different place. So from the Buddhist standpoint, what we call the real world is somewhat real, but mostly it's a picture of the world. It's like a movie. It's an artificial world that we've all created together out of our fears and our attachments. That's Buddhist view. So we have created this world that seems totally real, and we're like characters in the movie. Then the question is, if we're living in a kind of dream world, collective dream world, how do we ever get out of it? How do we ever get out of it? You know, I am old enough so that I remember pre-digital movies. I don't know if you know this, but before the digital revolution, movies used to be on rolls of film. This is very like primitive technology. There were these big rolls of film, and in a movie theater, there was a projector, and there was a job called projectionist. And he would take the film rolls and put them in these machines, and they would project, they would run light through the film. It would travel through the film into a lens that would magnify it and project it on the screen of the theater. And that's the old style of movie making, right? A light coming out of a bulb, passing through film, then through a lens and going onto the wall of the theater. And so the movie would be projected on this wall. And if you are a viewer of the movie, you know, what we do when we see a movie is we learn how to pretend that the world on the screen is the real world. This is actually the same thing we do when we are in the real world. We pretend it's the real world. When you go to a movie, you pretend to pretend, right? So when you go to a movie, you watch the movie and you pretend for 2 hours or an hour and 45 minutes that that's the real world, right? And it seems, when you're in it, it seems totally real, you know? So when Tom Cruise is hanging off the top of a train, you're thinking, hang on, you know? It seems so absorbing. But then, you know, as a kid, sometimes I would have this experience, right, where the projector the engine of the projector would malfunction. So you're watching these images that seem so real, and suddenly they start to slow down. And the images that seem so real begin to break apart. You know, if you know anything about movies, they're not continuous. They're pictures flashed at very high speed. So it's like flash, 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 flash. And there are tiny little intervals between the pictures, but they're so small and the pictures move so fast we don't normally see them. But when the engine of the projector would malfunction, it would slow down and you would begin to see the screen flickering, yeah? And suddenly there'd be these empty spaces between the flashes of images, right? This is very much like what happens to us when we meditate, actually, yeah? You know, eventually, if you meditate long enough, you'll notice that there are always these empty spaces between the flashes of somethingness, yeah? So you know, I remember as a kid, I was on a military base and we'd go to see movies and the projectionist would screw up and then the beautiful absorbing dream would start to break up and you could see the individual frames and there'd be these spaces between the frames. Actually, they were luminous spaces between the frames, you know. And suddenly the dream is shattered. Suddenly the dream is shattered. And, you know, you're in the audience and suddenly you're reminded, oh, this is not real, this is a movie, right? Okay, so what if you're a character in the movie, though? See, what if you're in the movie and you think it's real, right? And what if the projector, maybe if the projector malfunctions and you're a character in the movie, you'll go, hey, wait a minute, I'm disappearing and coming back. How is this possible, right? But maybe that doesn't happen. So how do we ever wake up to the fact that this is a dream, see? And that's what this koan is all about. You know, you can observe from moment to moment, forever, actually, and you may not wake up from the dream, you know? May not wake up from the dream because frame by frame, it's so absorbing. So what we need to do is realize that this is a movie, right, first of all. And then instead of looking for other characters in the movie or looking for, get safely off the roof of the train, right, we need to stop looking at the movie and we need to turn and look at the projector. Look at the projector, right? Where is this movie coming from? Where is this movie coming from? And that's the question people never ask, right? Unless they are following the Buddha's way, right? And then they begin to say, oh, wait a minute. You know, I thought that this reality was real. And then they begin to realize, wait, it's not real. It's not consistent. You know, it's punctuated by spaces of emptiness. Where, if this is the movie, where's the projector? See? And, all, you know, you could say all advanced practice in Zen is looking for the projector and not being seduced by the movie. Yeah. But you'll be seduced by the movie unless you wake up to the fact that it's not real. See? So this is a koan about how do people wake up if they're trapped in the movie and they don't know how to get free from it. See, and what Nansen does is to cut the cat in two, something absolutely shocking, you know? And maybe the monks have a moment where they suddenly realize this is not real. This is a mental construction. This is just something my mind has made up for me, right? And then they say, well, what is reality? That would be the beginning of of truly being on the path, see? The way Lin Chi Chan helps people to wake up from the movie is by pointing out contradictions, right? So every koan points you to, you could say, a contradiction, right? And something that that we believe to be true, but we see that it's not true, and then we don't know how to resolve the issue, right? So the first koan in the Mumonkan is a monk comes to a master Joshu, and he says, does a dog have Buddha nature? And we're waiting for Joshu to say, of course, all sentient beings have Buddha nature, see? But that's trapping the person in the movie. If I say, oh yes, all beings have Buddha nature, it says so in this sutra, I'm not waking the person up from the movie. So instead of answering the person straight on, Joshu does something that makes no sense at all. He says, nothingness, empty, nothingness. So, you know, basically this is like a contradiction. I'm worried about the dog having Buddha nature and you tell me nothingness. And basically, once you are in this kind of a contradiction or you're struggling with this kind of a question, you go through all the stages that I talked about yesterday. We try to figure it out intellectually, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, at some point what happens is you realize you can't think it through. And you have to go to this empty place in yourself and you wait for your Buddha mind to help you. It's like you have a wisdom in yourself, a deep wisdom, right? And if you stop, if you get out of your way, right, this deep wisdom will activate and help to solve the contradiction, right? It's like, every time we experience a contradiction in the Zen training, you know, it shows us in a way that the things we believed about the world are not true. You know, the things we thought were true are not true. If you have a staff, I will give you one. If you have no staff, I will take it away. See, that's a koan. Think, how can that be true? You know, that doesn't make any sense. These koans point to contradictions in our... things that we think of as very commonplace and obvious, right, may not be commonplace and obvious at all. So, for example, um, You could say, I'm speaking now, right? Or you could say, you're listening now. But if you sit down on the cushion and you go into samadhi and you look for the person who's hearing, you may discover that there's no such person, right? If you are speaking and you pay attention to your own mental processes, you may realize, you know, actually, I'm not speaking. Right now, I'm not speaking. It's interesting, you know. If you go into deep mushin and you observe your own thinking process, you realize, wait a minute, I say I'm thinking, but notice what's actually happening. Thoughts are arising from a mysterious place, right? We say, these are my thoughts. But if you watch your own mind, you see, thoughts are just popping into my head. And they're in my head for a little while, and then they're gone. I don't know where they're coming from, and I don't know where they're going. This is actually really like basic experience. We say, oh, I'm thinking, I'm speaking. But if you watch your own mental processes, you realize, you know, you can't predict what your next thought will be. You can't. Or at least the next three thoughts, right? We say, oh, it's my mind, it's my thoughts. But we aren't thinking our thoughts. They arise from a mysterious source, they linger, and then they go away. Where do they go? See? So this thing that seems so obvious, when we begin to investigate it, we realize it's not real at all. So we've been telling ourselves a story about how we think or about how we speak, right? But the story isn't true, right? It's not true. It doesn't take long to see it's not true. You know, Zen is all about questioning everything. I would say, you know, the method of Lin Chi Chan is to question everything. Question everything. Look carefully at everything. And when you do, you realize there are these contradictions. See? Now, you know, people don't like contradictions. They don't like them. I don't like them, right? I really dislike contradictions. I really dislike thinking that I'm a bundle of contradictions, but we all are, right? You know, I have a nephew who was staying with us last year, and he's a teenager, and he is a very annoying, he's a lovely kid, and he's super annoying, right? Because one of the things he does is he points out all the contradictions in everybody, so you want to strangle him, right? It's so frustrating to be around somebody like that. But, you know, when we encounter a contradiction in ourselves or in our reality, you know, what we want to do is close it up. We want to close it right up. And it's frightening when we open this up, when we see the contradiction, and then we realize, I don't know the answer. So if I, Kurt, am not thinking right now, my thoughts are coming from a mysterious place, where are they coming from? I don't know, right? I don't know. And that's very uncomfortable. You know, lots of people I know pride themselves on their super smart intellects. They think of themselves as being like geniuses, and many of the people I know are geniuses, actually. But actually, if you said to them, you know, your thoughts aren't even your own thoughts, they might be dumbfounded, right? And they might get angry. So Zen is all about calling attention to these contradictions. And we may dislike that experience. So a lot of koan training involves being given a koan that involves a contradiction and being plunged into this really frightening situation, right? Where, you know, we don't know how to answer, who am I? You know, who's speaking right now? The thoughts are just coming into my head. Who's speaking? See, now we're getting somewhere, see? Now we've moved beyond the lies and the bullshit, right, that we call reality. And we really have to inquire. And the way we inquire in Zen is to go into deep wuxing, deep emptiness. And by going into deep emptiness, we can experience the moment in a totally fresh way without all of our assumptions. And it can be a bit jolting, but the interesting thing is, see, please don't kill any cats. But when we encounter a contradiction, and instead of closing it up, we allow it to open up. See, we allow it to open up. We get a glimpse of fundamental reality. See, that's that we want to close the contradiction, but when we don't close it up, when we allow it, we allow ourselves to be with the contradiction. That's like those moments in the movie where the projector malfunctions, see? And we see the spaces between the pictures. And there's a chance, you know, at that moment that we will turn and see the projector. We will see the projector, right? The root, the source of mind, the mind source, right? In Sanskrit, it's the Dharmakaya, Fashen, right? So the way to see the Fashen is by plunging into contradictions, right? And entering deep wuxing and seeing a bigger picture, you could say, bigger picture. Eventually see the projector itself. So you know, Nansen does a terrible thing. He cuts a cat in two. And actually, a lot of Zen practice is like symbolically, right? Cutting lots of cats in two, cutting lots of realities in two. Nobody likes that. There's a kind of blood all over the floor when that happens sometime. But you know, actually, when we cut our reality in two, we get a glimpse of fundamental reality, real reality, right? Eventually awaken to our true nature, right? It's just on the altar we have a statue of Wen Shu Pusa, Manju Shri Bosa, right? And he has a sword. He cuts away at our illusions, cuts away at our illusions, cuts away at our illusions. And every time he cuts away at our illusions, we go, oh no, not, don't do that. But then, oh, life, so life energy, right? Life energy released. So Nansen has a student, Joshi, Jiaojo, who's deeply awake. He's gone through this process, right, of being, he himself has been cut in two many, many times, many, many times. And he sees the source directly, you know, without any any obstruction, right? So when he returns, he meets Nansen, and Nansen's so sad. He says, oh, what I did today was terrible. You know, the monks are not going to wake up. I've done a terrible thing, but I had to do it. You know, what would you have done? See, and Nansen is no longer bound by conventional reality. He acts from a place of luminous compassion, right? And he immediately puts his sandals on his head and walks back out the door. In other words, you know, he acts from a very different place than we do, because he's not afraid of not knowing. So, you know, all of us are practicing the great way. We're all cutting away at our illusions, and it's frightening. But when you move through your contradictions to the greater unity, you're getting closer and closer to waking up fully. And that's the art of the Sesshin, and that's the art of Chan, that's the art of Zen. So let's continue. Everybody's doing a wonderful job. Nansen Osho saw monks of the Eastern and Western halls quarreling over a cat. He held up the cat and he said, "If you can give an answer, you will save the cat. If not, I will have to kill it." No one could answer. Nansen cut the cat in two. That evening, Joshu returned and Nansen told him of the incident. Joshu took off his sandal, placed it on his head and walked out. "If you had been there," Nansen remarked, "you would have saved the cat." Mumon's comment, "Tell me, what did Joshu mean when he put the sandal on his head? If you can give a turning word on this, you will see that Nansen's decree was carried out with good reason, right? If not, danger." Mumon's verse, "Had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite." In other words, not kill, he would have brought life, see? I mean, look at the world, right? Look at the world. What a mess, you know? Because we live in falsehood, right? The world is a terrible place, right? A lot of the time, war, violence, unbelievable cruelty, right? But if we work through these contradictions, if we wake up from the dream that is the human world, the Sahaloka, right? Then we have a sword that brings life instead of killing. Right? The sword that cuts away illusion, Wenshu Manju's sword, brings life instead of killing. Had Joshu been there, he would have done the opposite. When the sword is snatched away, even Nansen begs for his life. Thank you.